My name is Patricia Kathleen, and this podcast series will contain interviews I conduct with female and female-identified entrepreneurs, founders, co-founders, business owners, and industry gurus. These podcasts speak with women and women-identified individuals across all industries in order to shed light for those just getting into the entrepreneurial game, as well as those deeply embedded within it. Histories, current companies, and lessons learned are explored in the conversations I have with these insightful and talented powerhouses. The series is designed to investigate a female and female-identified perspective in what has largely been a male-dominated industry in the USA to date. I look forward to contributing to the national dialogue about the long overdue change of women in American business arenas, and in particular, entrepreneurial roles. You can contact me via my media company website, wild.agency, that's WILDE.agency, or my personal website, patriciakathleen.com. Thanks for listening. Now let's start the conversation. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. This is your host, Patricia, and today I am sitting down with Jen Kokin, founder and CEO of Embrace the Ridiculousness of Life. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you so much for having me, Patricia.
Absolutely. I'm so excited to have you here. I'm going to read a quick bio on Jen, but before I do that, for everyone listening, a roadmap of today's podcast, should you want to skip around or refer back to it, we're going to get into Jen's academic background and early professional life, and then we're going to drop straight into unpacking her company, Embrace the Ridiculous of Life, and we'll get into the who, what, when, where, why, and of all of that, especially since it's such a unique company, how it's structured, and then we'll go straight into other endeavors that she has, including books and speaking engagements, and then we'll go straight to goals that Jen has over the next 3 years in regards to all of her endeavors. We'll wrap everything up with advice that she has for those of you looking to get involved with her, work with Jen, or kind of model your life after what she's done. So a really quick bio on Jen. Jen Kokin wants to live in a world where you're free to be yourself and achieving your soul's purpose, a vision that has driven her work as a coach, speaker, author, comedian for more than 20 years. Drawing on 3 decades of experience as a nonprofit leader and grassroots organizer, Jen helps CEOs and entrepreneurs overcome their self-made limitations and do their heart's work. But Jen's impact doesn't end there. She spent 6 years on the Denver stand-up comedy circuit and brings a sense of humor to every topic she addresses, including the experience of coping with her mother's diagnosis and death from ovarian cancer. Jen's first book, When I Die, Take My Panties, Turning Your Darkest Moments into Your Greatest Gifts, chronicles that experience and shares Jen's core message that everything that comes our way is meant to teach us about ourselves. Her second book, Embrace the Ridiculousness of Life, A Pocket Guide to Being a Better You, will show you how to look at the hard stuff, laugh at life's absurdity, and raise the bar on yourself. Each chapter gives short, no-nonsense how-tos to get you going, combined with pondering questions and exercises that will help you level up your skills and retrain old habits. When she's not crafting best-selling books or speaking to audiences around the country, you can find Jen eating Nutella by the spoonful in the nearest grocery aisle. You and me both, Jen. That is such a fantastic intro and bio. And I think after looking over your companies and synopsis of your books, it's a perfect introduction to you. But first, before we jump into all of your current endeavors, I wonder if you could just walk us through some of your academic history and early professional life.
Sure. Thank you so much. So interestingly enough, what I was educated in has nothing to do with what I'm doing now and everything to do with it. So I have my master's degree in political campaign management. So I was trained to manage issue and electoral campaigns and did that for 25 years.
Nice.
Around the country, local, state, and national elections. And I also started nonprofits and consulted with nonprofits to teach them how to raise money for the most part, because I found they didn't know how to talk about themselves. in a way that wouldn't bore people to tears. They were had great issues, but just couldn't, you know, we call it the elevator pitch, right? They just couldn't boil it down.
Yeah.
And at the same time I was doing all that, I was also a coach for an international personal growth and development company, leading their programs and coaching people. And that's what led me to coach somewhere at the end of that career, like over 8,000 people in 20 some years with them.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. It was a lot.
So what caused the pivot then into like the current, how did you start finding the book with your mother's passing? It sounds like that was the impetus for the book, but when did you launch Embrace the Ridiculousness of Life, your company?
It was a happy accident. So I had written the book. I started it in 2011, and it was my way of working through the grieving process. And I would write, you know, bawling my eyes out at like 5 a.m. till 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. when I had to work. Mm-hmm. And then it was 4 years of rewrites. If anyone's written a book, you know, it's not, for most people, it's not one and done. You know, it's a labor of love. So I went through 7 rewrites.
Wow.
Then I had a crisis of confidence. Like, I really have something to say. Is anyone really going to read this? And my writing coach and another coach said, kind of shook me by the shoulders and said, no, you've got to publish. So at the time I was a lobbyist for a solar company, lobbying municipalities to hire us to be their solar installer in their community. And my book was coming out any day in June sometime. And I walked into work on a Monday morning. My boss asked to meet me with me at 8 a.m. and he laid me off. And basically they reorganized the entire company, did away with the whole department I had built up over the last couple of years. And that was that. And the next day my book came out. And I, you know.
How auspicious. How interesting.
Yeah. But it took me a moment, right? Because mm-hmm. it sort of feels like I loved what I was doing. I loved the company. I loved the team I had built. And I had hired a publicist to help with the book. I just kind of figured, you know, the publicist would get the book out to whatever degree it was going to get out. And that was going to be that. But it took me about a week. And I remember my friend's husband called me. And I swear, Patricia, I don't remember what he said, but it was a 5-minute conversation. And he said what he said. He hung up the phone. It was kind of like, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing? Why are you looking for another job? I'd been laid off of 4 jobs over those 4 years writing the book. So it was sort of God, universe, whatever you want to say, goddess, Buddha, Allah, whatever you believe, your fence post, whatever you want to say, was trying to knock me on the head and say, you've got something to say. And so within a week, I said, all right, I'm going to go into this full time. I'm going to be a coach full time. And I'm going to get, my biggest thing was getting the book out there. And I knew nothing about marketing a book. I knew nothing about, I knew marketing from campaigns, uh-huh. right? I knew how to write speeches and that sort of thing, but I didn't know what it took to be an author, what it took to get my book out there. I had no idea that it doesn't matter unless you're a big, big name. You've got to market it all yourself, right?
Right.
And as it was, my mom had given me her, I had taken her iPod Touch. I had a list from there to tell people about the book, and a distant cousin wrote to me and said, you know, I'm a writer too. And I, you know, use this guy and he's really great. And he's got some great tips. His name's Steve Harrison and he has Harrison Communications, been really big with Jack Canfield, Brendan Burchard, like help them get on the map. Mm-hmm. And he was having a 1-hour session with Jack Canfield on how to be a successful writer and getting your book out there. And I thought, okay, let me listen to that. But you know, I had been laid off and I had a severance, but I didn't have a lot of money. So as I was listening to it, it occurred to me, you know, I should have known this before midway through, they were about to sell me something. And I thought, I don't have extra money mm-hmm. until he said, and if you buy right now, and it was $997, Bestseller Blueprint was the name of the course. If you buy right now, Jack Canfield will tweet about your book. And I launched out of my chair, got my credit card and bam, put the credit card down.
Okay.
And long story short, Jack, you know, I did a whole campaign around it. We reached 1 million people, became an Amazon bestseller. But my only thought was, I need to save women's lives. Mm-hmm. My mom, if I knew then when my mom got sick, when we didn't know what she had, what I know now, she might still be living. And so September's Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. And I wanted everything feeding into that, and then went to a publicity summit to pitch media and got on TV and radio and, you know, then realized I'm not making any money and I had to make money. And Steve actually pulled me aside and said, how are you going to make money? And I said, I want to coach. He goes, okay, you need to start making money. Mm-hmm. And his team helped me launch. I mean, they helped me launch the website. How do I get income from internet marketing? What does it mean to have a green you know, an evergreen content on your website. What's a tripwire? I didn't know any of these things, and they really helped me launch.
Nice. Yeah. So they helped you design you, but you had the knowledge. I mean, you had the years of experience and the information. A lot of the logistics that you're talking about are, you know, just that. They're kind of like these technical expertise, and they do make or break, you know, a bottom line. But it sounds like the coaching skills and the things that you had acquired were kind of built into that. Tell me about how does the comedy circuit play into this time scale now that we've kind of developed this trajectory from being a lobbyist to the book launching the day you leave the lobbying job to these campaign moments with the book in order to get it, you know, out and where it should be. And then from that going into developing your coaching empire, where is comedy fitting into that? This comedy.
Comedy is one of my outlets. You know what I mean? Like when I first started doing it, I had a dear friend who had, you know, had been a comedian for a long time and is still in Denver. And she helped me. I mean, you always need people around you. I you're right, from the perspective of what it took to coach or those experiences of launching campaigns, it becomes second nature. And then there is kind of the skill set you have to build to launch the book or what have you. Mm-hmm. But comedy for me was my outlet to write, to perform, to be in front of people. And I loved it. I loved connecting with people. And I would always write comedy about what was going on with me. So I wrote a whole sketch about my mom's cancer, and she helped me write some of the jokes. My friend Christina and I, before I moved, I was living in Denver and moved back to the DC area. And so I was continuing to perform when I could. You know, I used to do it once a week without fail. That was my commitment. And then it became once a month. When I went into writing my book and then kind of this whole series of my life, if you will, this, you know, piece of my life, my Igikai, which we can talk about.
Yeah.
It has, you know, I haven't been doing as much comedy. It's maybe once a month, and there's a couple rooms around me here in the Rockville, DC area that will call me and say, can you come and can you do a set for us? And then that gives me reason to write, but I honestly don't have as much time, and I miss it. I miss the performance aspect. And I weave comedy into everything. So I say to people who are going to work with me, if you can't laugh at yourself, if you can't handle me dropping a couple F-bombs or kind of poking fun a little bit, we're not going to get along. You know, I'm not the speaker for the financial industry or the insurance industry. I'm the speaker for entrepreneurs and startups and the tech industry and all creative types, because I'm a storyteller by nature. And that's where the comedy fits in. So on one hand, I get to weave it into what I'm doing. On the other hand, the speaking allows me to be in front of people, but it's still not the same as performing comedy, which I have love doing.
Well, and to itself, I have maybe more of a novice understanding. I have a great deal of understanding of writing, being, you know, third generation writers of all formats, but comedy writing is very, very specific. And the performance after comedy writing is its own genre. It's its own moment. You know, there's the comedy writing and then performing it, dealing with the timing and all of the other things that writing doesn't have the minutiae mixed into it. It sounds like a very arduous, free time hobby. It sounds more stressful than it is releasing. So it sounds like your personality is just based towards those things generated in that. Is it the creativity? You said the performance helps you. Do you find it to be an outlet for something that connects with your businesses outside of the humor? Are there other elements involved?
Well, it doesn't feel arduous to me at all.
Okay.
Because I see humor everywhere. I'm like, are you kidding? That just happened. Like, what are people thinking? Or I'll think about myself and how ridiculous I am when at the age of, you know, I'm 55 now. So the age of 35, I'm walking around DuPont Circle by myself on a sunny day when all of a sudden I burst out laughing so hard I'm about to pee my pants. Why? This is, I'll tell you this story. It's ridiculous because I realized why Noah brought the animals on by two. It wasn't to have a buddy, like when you were swimming in camp and they blew the whistle and you're like, hey, I got my buddy, nobody's drowned. It was actually to procreate. It was to make new animals after the flood.
Right.
And I'm like, who, why? That's just how my brain works.
Yeah.
So this realization
just came to you on.
Yeah. And it's a good outlet for me, you know, around dating and relationships to tell these stories. I find it more arduous to write books than I do to write comedy.
Do you think that Washington is more funny or corporate America? Where do you find more material?
Washington for sure is more funny these days, but I just think human behavior is hilarious. People do the things they do. And of course I'm saying this and I'm like, well, what's an example? And I have none. I have none. Clearly blank. People are not funny. I'm totally blanked out. Total blank out right now.
I got it. What about, did you launch Embrace the Ridiculousness of Life in 2011? And when you founded it, it sounds like you had these advisors that were kind of helping you with the logistics, as I referred to them before. Was it just you alone? Did you take any funding? Did you bootstrap it? Who were your first clients? How did you get that huge boulder of a ball rolling?
It was 2016. So it was that moment after I got laid off and that week. And then because I've worked on campaigns so long, I get stuff done. I don't know if I can swear on the podcast.
You can, go for it.
I get shit done. Like, you tell me X and I'm going to go do it and nothing's going to stand in my way. Kind of like your philosophy of you never take no. That's just an opening for a conversation, right?
Yeah. Right.
So same. So I had incorporated the following week. I was like, okay, I don't know things. What don't I know? Who do I know that could know that? Facebook was always my friend. Hi, community. I need to do X. What do I do? How do I do it? And then once I got a hold of Steve Harrison's group, his stable of coaches, they kind of had everything. Image makeover, what's a speaker page? How do you put together your website? And they, one of their coaches helped me design my first offering, and I pulled my list from my Gmail, email addresses and some folks from LinkedIn and said, okay, here's what I'm doing. And I had when I left Steve in October at this publicity summit, and he said, you got to make money. And I said, I know. And I had worked with this guy, Jeffrey, to do my first email, which was going out that day. I had my first client in a week. And that guy was a client for we're just sort of ratcheting things down almost 3 years. And then it became about testing things. And I think you have to be able to throw spaghetti on the wall. Mm-hmm. I tested online webinars. I hated it. Like, hey, here's my webinar for $27. I freaking hated it because I was marketing that every month, distinct from thinking big picture and trajectory and where do I want to go. And really, I love being in front of a lot of people speaking. I love coaching people live on stage. I don't care if it's thousands of people, whoever it is, hundreds of people, 10 people, 3 people. That is my sweet spot because I want people empowered. Mm-hmm. And I want people to feel like they've got the space to pursue their dreams.
So how do you find the topics that you find most predominantly effective when you do this public speaking and the coaching and things like that? And also, do you take individual contracts for your coaching, or how is it set up? You have public speaking, you kind of work through things that felt or don't feel right since the launch, but what are your main areas right now?
Well, there's a couple of things and the way I found the topics was really a little bit hit or miss. When I launched the webinar, I had 12 topics, everything from courageous conversations. I don't think Kim Scott's book Radical Candor had come out at that point in time, and I certainly didn't know about it. But I knew that if you were willing to have tough conversations with people, you could literally transform your relationships. I knew that everybody has an inner critic, and how do we identify it and let it go? I knew that, in business, I'm a huge believer in Gallup Strengths Finder, which is a way to identify your natural talents. And so I often do workshops both with my clients and their teams, because it leads to people working better together. They're more productive, they're happier. Emotional intelligence was a big one. I'm now effortless networking. I've been asked to do that quite a number of times. And some of these are born out of the fact that, for example, I hate networking. Why? I love people, but I hate networking because I'm really a closet introvert. I spend a lot of time by myself because I'm with people all the time. And I love being in my space, reading, writing, watching Netflix, whatever it is, or cooking dinner. Cooking is a huge outlet for me with friends. And I would go to walk into these events where I knew I needed to meet people and would find myself with the same group of people in the corner, or only meeting the first person and kind of talking to them the rest of the night and going, okay, phew, but I didn't achieve my goal, which was to meet as many people as possible. Yeah. So that has been a big topic. And then I was recently asked, and I'm so honored about this, to be the keynote for a group called Hatch Tribe in Charleston, which is a global connection of women entrepreneurs and CEOs who, this woman's been working with them through the years. And in their last event in July, imposter syndrome came up, mm-hmm. you know, and they, oh, am I too ambitious? You know, I don't know how to ask for more money. And I said to her, it's based in Charleston, South Carolina. I said, is it cultural? Is it like mm-hmm. a Southern thing or is it a female thing? We know it's a female thing for sure, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'm creating a talk called, you know, Are You Willing to Fail Spectacularly? Because 15 years ago, a buddy of mine looked at me and said, are you willing to fail spectacularly, in so many words? Because I was about to, I sold everything lock, stock, and barrel and moved to Colorado to be with my then boyfriend. And that was a pivotal moment for me where I was willing to give it all for the possibility of something, the possibility of love, the possibility of saving women's lives. So it's kind of trial and error. And then there was another piece that you had asked me besides topics.
I was wondering about if you took individual clients at this point, or are you just mainly focused on these more large audience speeches and conversations?
Absolutely. And that the way I find a lot of those individual clients is through those speaking engagements. I mean, obviously I want to touch as many lives as possible because I want to empower as many people as possible. But for CEOs in particular, they don't have a confidant. They don't have somebody they can mm-hmm. talk to about what's going on in the boardroom or quite honestly their bedroom, meaning just their personal life and how that's impacting their professional life.
Right.
And I become their confidant, but we have fun doing it because people have got to laugh. They've got to be able to laugh at their own absurdity and the ridiculousness of life because life's absurd.
Absolutely. I want to climb really quickly into your books. Before we began recording, we talked a little bit about, and you've mentioned your first book, When I Die, Take My Panties, Turning Your Darkest Moments into Your Greatest Gifts, it chronicling, you know, your experience of your mother's passing and things of that nature. Can you kind of reflect back now and give some information for everyone listening regarding like the trajectory that writing that book and then editing it and putting it out, it took you, you know, seven rewrites and 4 years. But looking back now, what are the pieces of advice that you glean from that to be the most crucial?
Yeah. One point I forgot to make about asking about, it ties the comedy with the speeches, as I often will do mm-hmm. workshops on how to inject humor into advocacy or how to inject humor into telling your story about having cancer. I'm doing that event with a group in June, kind of tying that piece together. So the book, the first iteration wrote itself. It was my grieving process. And I found a writing coach and she had a group, she's now an agent, but back then she had a group of women who were all writing books and we were a collective. And so I would make promises to her about how often I would write. And then once a week, we'd get on Skype together. I think it was once a week, every other week. Okay. We were writing on a Saturday from 9 to 4, depending on the time zone. Mm-hmm. We'd say what we were going to accomplish. We'd support each other on Skype during the writing process. And at the end of the day, we would say what we did accomplish. And then I had a writing partner as I was going through the editing. And she was living in Switzerland at the time. And so she was 6 hours ahead and I was working full time. So I would get up at 5:30 and we'd log in from 6 to 7 and okay, this is the piece I'm going to work on. But everything I've ever done has always been in partnership with others, whether it's an individual or a group, except, and even, not necessarily writing itself, but the creative thinking process, mm-hmm. because I enjoy the process of having someone else to bounce my ideas off of and just hear myself speak out loud and challenge me and wait a minute, that sounds goofy. Or what do you mean about this? And help me articulate so I can hone things down. I can only get so far when I'm by myself in this noggin.
Right.
And so I asked for a lot of help from people.
How did you originally find these writing groups and all of these workshopping efforts that like started off, you know, your original push for it? Were they just meet up? Were these random social interactions or how were you introduced?
This was a group of my friends back in Denver and we all knew each other through the you know, I used to coach for a personal growth and development company called Landmark Worldwide. They did something called the Landmark Forum, which was a basic introductory course. So we all knew each other and had been in courses together through the years. And so I had kind of a same lingo and parlance. And I knew this one woman was through saying, you know, I need help writing my book. I don't know how to get started. Someone said, have you spoken to Kristen Muller? She's an author of 3 books and she's helping people write their books. And so I just phoned her and said, you know, how do you work? What do? You know, help me. And then she found me my publisher because she became an agent for that publisher. And she really pushed for my book to be published by them because it's very much a Christian-based publishing company. And given that I dropped the F-bomb, you know, originally it was 27 times in the book and she thought that was a little overdone. So she asked me to cut it down to 13 and there's an F-bomb in the first chapter. Like, ooh, that was a little out of their comfort zone probably to be publishing me. Oh my goodness. Yes.
I like that. Well, so, I mean, it's from what you've kind of sussed out through, you know, your musings about it, it sounds like turning humor into advocacy and everything being done in partnership and your ability to ask for help, even with this process, really formed the tenets of the book. Do you think that you carried those in more of a refined form back into your second book, Embrace the Ridiculousness of Life, A Pocket Guide to Being a Better You?
Yeah, that book, I jokingly said you can read it on the toilet or over a glass of wine because it's 60 pages, you know, and there was a coaching group that wanted to have me on their site and they said, you need a tripwire. And I was like, a trip what? They're like, a tripwire. You need something we can sell for like $4.99, $3.99 that'll get people invested and interested in you. I said, okay. And I used to write every week and set out, do a blog every week and an email every week. And so I kind of pulled from, and all those emails and the writing I did, I always use my own life as an example of where I've quite honestly screwed up and been a jerk and a big asshole. And what I learned from that to teach others, A, that I'm human and we all screw up and you just got to be able to learn from it and not beat yourself up. So I kind of culled the best of those lessons into this book that's super, you know, I tell people like throw it in your purse. And if you're having a rough day, just open it to any chapter. They're like 3 pages, 4 pages long, but each one has an exercise. So for example, if you're having a rough day and how you know you're having a rough day, what I tell people is if you're not empowered, if you've lost your sense of humor, you're not empowered. A number one red flag if you've got no sense of humor. So open up the book and there's a chapter called, I forgot the name of it, but it's about what have you been stepping over? You know, ignoring what messes have you not cleaned up for yourself and start looking at all those things you haven't said, the things you haven't done, where have you broken your promises, your agreements, et cetera. Start putting all that stuff back together because when we step over things, our self-expression just whittles down, you know, it just, we lose our self-expression because we have all these things we haven't said or we're hiding, et cetera. So it's a little quick parables and lessons to get you back on the horse and back on the trail. And I was trying to think of another horse, the bridle back, no, the bridle's in the horse's mouth, whatever. You get my trail.
I got you. Yeah. I'm here for you and all your metaphors.
Thank you so much.
The retraining of old habits. That is a term that sounds simple, but I think it's like at the crux of what's holding everyone back, especially Absolutely. As you know, people kind of continue through even finding people who are, I find, luckiest, you know, who know what they want to do, what makes them happiest. Just finding that can take the first 40 years of life. And then retraining old habits for me, when I look around and I speak with all of the women and non-binary individuals that I've been interviewing, it seems like those that aren't quite getting to the happiness are those that are still trying to retrain, you know, the brain and you see the goal, the proper goal in the distance now, and you're looking towards how to get there. And I find that habits get in the way. It's not so much as the tools needed, but how to also kind of relinquish these tools that are hindering. So what are your main, do you have like some kind of key axiomatic pieces of advice when you get into retraining habits?
Yeah. And I think what you said is so important. You are retraining your brain. It's a neuroscience. You're talking about neuroscience because Any habit we have that doesn't serve us, we have put together when we were a small child. And it's usually in the response to some threat, someplace we didn't feel safe, someplace we felt all alone. And that first reaction becomes a brain pattern. And then the next time it happens, you know, it ingrains that brain pattern. The brain doesn't distinguish between you physically being at the Grand Canyon or thinking about it. It thinks you're already there. So if there's the same threat coming or some threat coming at you, it thinks it's the same level as all the other times that you felt threatened or you felt alone or you felt lost. And that, you know, that is our brain. That's an amygdala hijack, right? And the amygdala is that flight, fight, or freeze response. So the first thing is admitting you have a problem and being able to identify those reoccurring patterns or limitations that you have. I say all my coaching, and there's like an inside game and an outside game. The inside game is the self-awareness piece. This is what we're talking about here. Because once you're able to key in on that, then there's the outside piece, which I'll you know, we can talk about in a minute. But besides being able to identify the habits, now, okay, where do they get triggered the most? What relationships? Is it at work? Is it at home? Is it with your mom? Is it with friends? What are the situations? So we can identify the things that cause you to kind of react. We all know we're doing it, and it's like a bad accident. You can't take your eyes off it, but you can't help yourself from reacting that way. So we look at the triggers around you and the red flags that are telling you you're about to react that way. And then we come up with new ideas for exercises, for practices to interrupt those patterns, interrupt. And you're right, it is a retraining. It's an interruption of that brain pattern until the moment where you go, oh. And part of it is connecting with the emotional piece of that. You know, I was coaching a client yesterday, and her big thing is getting to sleep early. And we talked about, I said to her, well, how does that make you feel? And we got to it. And ultimately it makes her, when she's in bed at 9 o'clock, because she runs a school and she's got a family and she's a treasurer at her church, she's got a lot of things going on. When she wakes up rested, she feels like she has freedom because she can then get into work early. And I said, okay, so instead of putting in your calendar, go to sleep at 9 p.m., put in, I am free. And in parentheses, go to sleep at 9 p.m. You get connected to that emotion. Then boom, you're creating a new brain pattern. But that one's a baby brain pattern. And we got to keep putting that, whatever those practices are, in place to ingrain that new brain pattern. As are you familiar with Joe Dispenza and his books? And he talks a lot about this, but I call it brain glue. Like, you have your neurons and there's a pattern between them, and you're unsticking the brain glue and creating a new stickiness for a new pattern. And you got to adhere that pattern and ingrain it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's practice. I think it's not one of those, I picked up skiing, I know how to ski. It's a constant revisit, you know, to those, constant. Especially retraining. It's, I find it with, at least within my own personal life, 14 times more difficult than originally learning, unlearning, absolutely. And then relearning. It takes patience as well. So,
and that's important, Patricia, because I think it takes patience with ourselves and compassion. Mm-hmm. Compassion for ourselves. And the human brain is 50 to 60,000 thoughts a day, and 80 to 85% are negative. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a lot of compassion for ourselves, and we compare ourselves a lot to others. You're right. It is, it's the harder thing. It's the hardest thing to do as an adult.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting that you dive into that. That's one of the, like, the main core points of your book as well, because I think it's a crucial one that people overlook, when especially when they're goal making, you know, or trying to obtain more difficult goals, when they're outlining a game plan for their future. When you look forward to the goals of where you're at with the ridiculousness of life, the company, as well as book writing and things of that nature, what are your goals over the next 3 years? And how do you set that up? Do you vision board when you go to make your own personal goals for yourself and for your company? Do you delineate those two? Do you keep a horizon as broad as 3 years? How is that set up for you personally?
Well, it's a lot of different ways that I set it up. I have a strategy partner, accountability partner, I meet with once a week, and we actually have 2 3-hour chunks set aside before the end of the year, one to complete the previous year, because I have a free workbook on my website that's called Celebrate Your Wins, Achieve Greater Success. Because when we fail, we're great at picking it apart. When we succeed, we're like, great, good, on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. We don't figure out, well, what made me successful? What was my secret sauce? So we can repeat that stuff. So it's important to have a clean slate before you create. And then we're going to be creating those longer term goals. So one is, again, theme, partnership, teamwork, doing that together. I've got a whiteboard or draw it out or design it. I use power mapping, which is like, you know, you start with a circle, like here's me in the middle, and then branching out, what are the pieces and how do they all connect? It's how I did a lot of my work as an organizer, because I think visually, and so I have to see that layout. But then every morning, part of my ritual for myself and self-care, I tell people I'm not ready for prime time until 10 a.m. Eastern, because when I get up in the morning, I meditate and I journal. And part of my journaling is 5 things I'm grateful for, 10 dreams I have as if they've already happened. New York Times bestselling author. When I Die, Take My Panties, the movie. I want it on like the Oxygen Network because I got to educate more women about ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. Being in a committed, awesome partnership with a great man, you know, things like that. All the things of being a world traveler, you know, going to umpteen countries, all the things as if they've already happened. And then I write in there what I want more of in that day. I want more joy, flow, and ease. And then I write my affirmation. So I have it, my gratitude, my dreams, my intention, my affirmation. And then it's continuing to have an accountability partner to make promises, you know, say whether I achieve those promises or not with no loss of power if I didn't, make new promises or whatever it's going to be. So that's the way I kind of approach the whole thing. But one of my big goals over the next 3 years is to have my next book out that I've been working on. And it is called The Best Mistake I Ever Made, nice. How America's Top CEO Succeed. So I've been interviewing some of the country's best top CEOs, like the chair of Dunkin' and Texas Roadhouse and Visteon Corporation, a bunch of other, you know, other entrepreneurs and CEOs, because my theory is those people who succeed have failed, but never became a failure. Their mindset didn't go to failure. They just got it was a fail. Okay, great, move on. And that's what I'm finding out. So there's going to be a story woven in there. That's number one. Number two is I want to launch a podcast, and I'm in conversation with a good friend who has a group called Million Women Strong. Mm-hmm. And the foundation's strategic direction is to empower women financially, emotionally, and spiritually. And we're talking about her and I doing a podcast together to empower women and have them succeed in life. And I always say this, a client waiting list, you know, and speaking all around the world, because I actually want to live. I'm a nomad at heart. So I'm going to live everywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I do my goals, it's personal and professional, you know, because I can coach people from anywhere also.
Yeah. I don't think one can live in the vacuum. Not anyone I've spoken to thus far. Maybe I will meet that rare individual, but I find that when goals are separated out or delineated from one another, I don't believe that personal denotes the professional or vice versa, but they live together in tandem, you know, like the brain and the stomach. You know, they're very much so influenced by one by the other. I want to know if you, this is a curious situation. If you had a young woman or a woman identified individual come up to you and say, listen, you know, had a good couple decade long run in Washington as a lobbyist, and I've just started to write, you know, my first book. I'm leaving that industry behind. I'm getting ready to kind of start my own thing. What are the top three pieces of advice you would give her, knowing what you know now?
So I just had this conversation with someone last night, legitimately.
Good. Yay.
Number one, are you familiar with this term, Ikigai?
No.
So yes.
Oh, yes. No, go ahead. Go. Yes. Tell me.
Okay. So I'm using this app to help me meditate. They mentioned it and I started researching it. It's this Japanese phenomenon of finding your purpose. And it's the intersection of what your skills are, what you're passionate about, what the world needs, and how you can earn a living. And so the first thing I said to this woman last night, because she's like, should I write? Should I speak? I could do this. I could do that. I go, number one, you have to figure out what are your core values? What are the energies that you want to bring into the world? You know, some of mine are playfulness and authenticity. And if what I do everything that aligns with that, I've got to bring play to everything I do. If it's a serious business, I can't thrive. Find out what you're passionate about. Is your passion to speak about, you know, she was a, interestingly enough, I don't know how you would call it. She was supposed to be using her CPAP machine and didn't, and she almost died because she had too much carbon monoxide in her body and had no idea. and was in a coma for a month and didn't know and came out of it and is fine, but it was a wake-up call for her. So I think number one, find your passion, find that ikigai. And then it's creating the plan, which is what I do with people. That's part of the work I do, because as a campaigner, you have an end goal called an election and you have to have so many votes. And we know you have to knock on so many doors to get to so many people to turn out those votes. It's all the world, Patricia, is a math problem. And if we figure out how many calls we have to make to get to all the people or how many books we have to sell or whatever, we can figure out that plan and then implement it. And some people are good at implementing plans. Other people need an accountability buddy, So how do you do that? So I'd say number one, find what you're passionate about. What's your ikigai? Number two, develop a plan. And number three, implement it. If you're not countable to implement promises to yourself, which most of us are not, find someone to help you, whether it's a coach or a buddy system or a group of women or men or whomever that you, group of people, you know, whatever, humans, right, to surround you that bring you that bring you light. That's one of my other dreams every day, is I surround myself with people that fill my heart with joy and I fill theirs with joy. Because if there's people around you that zap your energy or you have this like icky feeling around them, jettison those people, jettison those relationships.
Yeah.
Find a way to do it gracefully.
Absolutely. I think it's crucial too. I like the philosophy, and I had come across it, ironically with another, kind of multifaceted, powerhouse, a female entrepreneur and, business owner and investor, who had written about, ikigai as well. And they, what I liked when I studied it, after she had referenced it in her stuff, was it describes the nexus of kind of everything. And I think in the American culture, sometimes we say, well, what's your purpose? What are you good at? What do you like to do? What are you most happy when you're doing it? And the factors that's taken into consideration with the Japanese philosophy is much more holistic. And so you're describing, you really understand all of it, you know, in the end, when you get those answers. I like it. I mean, finding your ultimate nexus, your ultimate purpose, develop a plan and implement it. I mean, I think that put it on my grave. You know, that sounds awesome. I think that's fantastic. And I think those are crucial pieces of advice. You'd be a good buddy. You'd be a good friend to sit next to on the plane.
Yeah.
Walking advice, right?
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say quickly too, that I loved when I was studying this as well, is they say, you know, maybe your work is your ikigai. And they say, never retire, because that's your reason for being. Or maybe it's raising a family, or maybe it's painting. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be whatever you think it ought to be. It can be anything. You can get that same experience of purpose. It's what gets you out of bed in the morning. If what gets you out of bed in the morning is raising your family or being a great partner or volunteering with an after-school program, if that's what gets you out of bed, that's what you look forward to. That's your ikigai, and don't ever stop.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Not ascribing traditional values to it with money and things of that nature. I agree. And I think that that's a difficult one to do and still try to be prolific. You know, that it takes a great deal of courage and honesty with oneself. So that's a good point. I like that a lot. Well, we are out of time. We're going to wrap up. I just wanted to say, Jen, thank you so much for your candor and all of the information. I think that your companies and your work and the work that you're getting ready to do and all of your information is not just valid and useful, but it's also, for me, clever and entertaining is lost a lot of times when we go for, you know, exploration and utility. And I think that you've brought humor back into landscapes. It definitely needs to survive and thrive in. And I just wanted to say thank you. I think your stuff is fascinating, and I encourage everyone to go out. Her name is Jen Kokin, and grab When I Die, Take My Panties, Turning Your Darkest Moments into Your Greatest Gifts, as well as Embrace the Ridiculousness of Life, A Pocket Guide to Being a Better You, as well as what's the third one on the horizon?
It's called, and I always have to look at the mock-up that I did, The Best Mistake I Ever Made, How America's Top CEOs Succeed. So I figure it'll be out in about a year.
I can't wait for the launch. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much, Patricia, for both, you know, inviting me, this podcast, and like all you're doing to empower women. We all appreciate you.
Thank you so much. And for everyone listening, I appreciate the time you've given me today. And until we speak again, remember to always bet on yourself. Sláinte.